Hello, I'm Luke Nessler, the host for Express Yourself. I've been holding down Friday afternoons on KDNK for 9 years now, and I have thoroughly enjoyed talking about the thriving art scene in the Roaring Fork Valley and talking to the artists who comprise it. I'll be away for 6 weeks. Please enjoy these encore presentations drawing from the extensive Express Yourself archives.
Oh, it must. The passion.
Yeah? You have a passion for your art?
the passionate, fiery side of Scorpio, I guess.
Well, that's a good thing. I mean, what's the point of doing it if you don't have passion?
That's right. Yeah. There is no point.
Exactly. Okay.
Everyone should
Interview's
do art, whether,
done.
Ever, yeah. whether they have passion or not. You should be an artist.
Right on.
We're all artists in some sense.
You know what? The interview's done. That's all we
okay,
have to say.
Okay, great. It's good talking to you. I'm out of here.
What is your art?
Well, I am, I guess I classify my art as photorealism. I take a photograph and I, in a sense, I enlarge it. And I, with my eye, I transpose it onto paper. I specialize in color pencil, graphite, charcoal. This show I'm doing actually a painting, which is fairly new to me. I've done a couple paintings in the past, but I really like pencil. So I thought I'd challenge myself a little bit and, branch out and try something new. Oil. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. I have actually two new pieces that the public hasn't seen. One of them is the painting. It's a painting of a bighorn sheep, which is, it's a pretty intense, evil-looking sheep, and I thought it was a really fascinating image of this guy. And the other one is a graphite piece of my horse. And as most animal owners, I'm obsessed with my horse. And so I wanted to capture sort of his beauty the way that I see it. So I got a really pretty basic image photograph of him by a friend of mine, and then I decided I wanted to just enhance it a little bit more. And that's the cool thing about photorealism is you can just take, something that on surface looks pretty simple and regular. I mean, that's not necessarily the right word to use, but something somebody has seen before, and you can find like a further depth of beauty in it through photorealism. At least that's what I found, and that's what I try and bring to my pieces.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Have you been playing with photorealism for a long time?
Well, the first piece that I did in this style was when I was about 15. I had seen it. I think I was at the stock show and I had seen a photorealist picture. And, from far away, I thought it was a photograph. I was like, whoa, what a great photograph. And I got closer and I realized it was pencil. And I was just blown away that someone could create that. And I told myself finally, by the time I was around to 15, had taken a couple art classes, but I was like, I want to try that. And I did. I just sort of challenged myself to do it. I guess you could say I was self-taught because no one really ever told me what it took to be a photorealist, quote unquote. So I just found an image in a magazine and tried to just with my eye replicate it. I didn't do any tracing. I didn't put the paper over the photograph in any sense. I just wanted to dive into the detail with sight. And from there, I guess I didn't really do much more photorealism for, maybe another 5-7 years. After college, I actually was training horses, studying horse training in New York and Florida, and some of the horse clients wanted me to draw their horses. And so I had a little bit more practice doing, commissions and portraiture type stuff. But I didn't really decide to be a professional at it until the last couple years. And then actually coming up to the Roaring Fork Valley has really sort of launched my desire and passion, because I just see so many amazing artists up here. And
mention amazing horses.
Amazing horses.
I'll bet there's some amazing
so
horses.
So inspiring. Well, and this is the first horse drawing that I have done probably for 10 years. Surprisingly, because I've just done other things, you know, dogs, boyfriends, other images, you know.
The two are equal, right?
That's right. The same level. The dogs were way more enjoyable to draw. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, so I guess I'm, I guess this is new to me, you know, on, as I said, on two levels. I'm new. I've decided. I've sort of made a decision that I am going to be a professional artist. So that's a new thing for me. And then, in addition to bringing out some new pieces, so I'm really excited about the show. It's
wow, that's impressive.
Really fascinating.
So now that you've made that decision,
yes,
Elizabeth Ricks, how's it going? Do you sit down and draw every day?
I decided to become a professional artist February 1st. And on February 1st, I woke up at 5 a.m. and I was in bed by 8:30 p.m. And I drew for 8 hours straight that day.
Whoa.
And I have done that every single day since. With the exception of a couple days that I had to, you know, run some errands and eat and grocery shop and feed my horse.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, but I've decided, it's such an exciting feeling, you know, making that decision that I'm not going to hold myself back from what I believe I was put on this planet to do, you know. So that's a new sensation for me. And I think a lot of people, you know, don't pursue their dreams or the life they haven't lived. You know, we have the life that we have lived, and then we have the life that we've wanted to live. And I think we sort of hold ourselves back from leading the life that we want to live for so many reasons. And, you know, just fear of failure or fear of
success.
Yeah. You know, were my biggest reasons. And so I've just sort of made that commitment to just honor, you know, I'll say it, honor my gift. So
February 1st, we're talking, what's today? It's the 18th.
Yes.
So do you have 18 drawings?
Oh, gosh. These photorealistic drawings probably take a minimum of 30 hours.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'd honestly, if I spent the sort of time on them that I'd like to, it would take me a couple months to, you know, and I'm talking, you know, bigger scale too. You know, 5 feet tall or something. I'd like to start doing some images like this. The image of my horse is 18 by 18 inches in the picture.
That's the one that's in the show.
Yes.
The chapel show.
Yes. Uh-huh. And that's the one I finished. So I just completed him. That's pretty much the new drawing that I've done in February. But this, the bighorn sheep is also, hopefully, fingers crossed, that'll be finished by Sunday.
You know, I haven't spent a lot of time with horses, but I've read about the bond that the human has with the horse.
Oh, my gosh.
And that so much of it is based on totally nonverbal communication.
Oh.
That I wonder how you capture that in a drawing.
Oh, my goodness. That's such a great question. They're socio-sensual beings, you know, meaning they respond so much from their gut, you know, just sort of a trait that they evolved with. And certainly my horse, I didn't mention this, but I'm also a horse trainer on the side. Shameless plug of all my businesses here.
Hey, that's why you're here.
Yeah,
right? That's honest. Let's be honest. No,
which is why drawing a horse, you know, is so much more meaningful to me. But, you know, I believe that horses in my life are here to really be a mirror for me, you know, and help me become a better person on many levels. And my horse came into this world specifically for that, I believe. And because horses are, you know, really honest with us about, you know, how honest we're being, you know, about our emotional state and about, like, the things in life that are important. And that's sort of, you know, the basis of my training with horses. And this horse is really special to me. His name is Jess Storo, Jesse for short. But he's been a really great teacher and helped me let go of, you know, a lot of my emotional baggage. And, you know, it's just, he is really, he's there for me when I am present in myself. He will connect with me the most those times that I am really balanced around him, you know, emotionally, and I, you know, my inner strength comes out, and but I'm also fair and you know, don't bring all of my human junk to the ranch. So drawing him has been really special. I titled the drawing Oro, O-R-O.
Gold.
So yeah, gold. He's a Palomino for one. But just a spoiler alert, the drawing is graphite, so it's black and white, but you can see he's a Palomino in it.
Well, that says something right there about the piece.
Right, huh. Totally. I chose that title for many reasons. So I call him Just Oro. Because his name when he came to me was Jester, and I thought that was great. And we called him Jesse for short, and I wanted him. I was like, Jesse, you need a manly name. And he's a quarter horse, so he has some Spanish bloodlines. And so I was like, let's give you some Latin flair. So I call him Gestoro. Now, oro not only means gold, but in Latin it means to seek or to beg or to question. And he has, what's really interesting about that is he's got a marking on his forehead that is a reverse question mark. It's like, you know, some horses have blazes straight down. Uh-huh. He's got, his is in the shape of a question mark, but it's not, it's as though there's a mirror on it. So I read into things really deep.
I was like,
whoa. This horse is here to put a mirror against me and ask, you know, challenge me every day, you know, what are you doing? Huh. How are you bettering yourself? How are you, you know, how are you being present in this world right now? Yeah, I mean, that's what I've read into it. And
wow.
You know, whether that's his intention or not, I certainly take a lot from it. So Oro, I chose that title because I believe it's gold, you know, and it's also this image of him. I was touched by it when I first saw the photograph. And I thought this would be a perfect representation of everything that he means in my world. You know, just the expression in his eye and like sort of the drama of his mane.
How long have you had this horse?
He was actually given to me. It's been
so
about
it was
2 years.
A gift. You didn't buy it.
That
makes it even more meaningful.
Oh my gosh, there's so many layers to this. So Jesse is actually the second horse in my world, in my life, that has been offered to me for free. When I was 10 years old, I had a Palomino named Trigger that I was leasing. And the owner offered to give him to me because I was the only one that decided that I wanted to put the energy into training this guy. He was kind of a booger. And I fell in love with him, and he fell in love with me. And then, of course, my parents at the time were like, oh, it's not the, you know, cost of the horse, it's the upkeep. And so they're like, no, we're not going to have him. And, of course, I was devastated. And so Trigger, you know, was sold to someone else. And that was the biggest heartbreak of my life. No. So I moved up to the Valley about 2 years ago, and I met a nice lady by the name of Alicia Evans, who is sort of known in the Valley for her dog training. And I was like, oh, I'm a horse trainer. And she's like, I have horses. And I was like, oh my gosh, I have a dog. Let's do a trade. So I came out and met her two horses, and Justoro and I fell in love. And and she was like, I can't believe how amazing he is with you, Elizabeth. Would you like to have him? And I was like, what? And so I figure it was the universe's way of saying, you know, second time around, make it happen. And so.
What a great story.
Isn't that cool?
Elizabeth
yeah.
Ricks, my goodness. You know, you've already got such an incredible relationship with that horse that it's just sort of mind-blowing to think. And you're drawing it, which is sort of a documentation of your evolving relationship.
Exactly.
And I'm presuming you're going to draw that horse many more times in the future.
So. Yeah.
So
yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how those...
Sort of trace our journey together.
Yeah, that's great. Holy cow.
Yeah.
Wow, this has been so good. Elizabeth Ricks, thank you. Yeah.
It's been my pleasure. I'm super excited. Come check out the show. It's new to me. It's going to be really wonderful. A lot of really cool artists and pieces, new pieces.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Nancy Lovendahl is a longtime Valley resident and sculptor with exhibitions, commissions, and residencies around the world. Nancy spent a month in China in 2009 and spoke about her experience there on Express Yourself in January of last year, prior to her show of drawings at the Wiley Community Arts Center. The title of the show, What is Here? What is There? What is that?
Well, that was the way I could ground my experience of a 2-month residency that I had in Beijing at the end of 2009. So you can imagine being dropped off your plane and winding up in a renovated historic pickle factory on the northeast end of Beijing, which... The size of Beijing is incomprehensible, and I found out that I was in one of the major immigrant corridors of Beijing in my studio, and the Red Gate Residency Program was where I landed, and really was a fantastic way to have a base and some resources so that I could experience Beijing and kind of hit the restart button on my creativity.
Well, I imagine that's the case because art in China is a far different thing than art in the United States, isn't it?
Well, it really is. I mean, there's a 6,000-year recorded history of some of the finest art in the world. Mm-hmm. But as you know, that was mostly, well, completely imperial driven. So the arts into the mainstream were extremely limited. And then, of course, with the communist period that covered 3 generations, the ability for people to have any kind of free thinking at all, creative thinking, was very limited. In fact, many of the artists that I met, a few years ago when I was there, they had these beautiful, shiny MFAs from, you know, the best university in China, and they didn't know what to make. So they were just learning to mine what they were wanting to say because it had been so long since they could say anything. And of course, the artists that I knew that were in jail while I was there, that was a compelling experience to post myself next to. Mm-hmm. I mean, in this country, I've never been told what to make. And in China, that's very different.
Hmm. Did you find that as a result of that kind of censorship, that the artists were self-censoring? Or just
the
opposite?
No, they were speaking in codes.
Oh, interesting. Tell me more.
Well, there's a great story. While we were there, my husband, as you know, Scott Keating, and I were going through a major arts district that's called 798. And it's kind of like the Soho of Beijing. And we were coming around upstairs, and we hit the top of the stairs, and there were 2 army guys, fully armed, right in front of the studio gallery of the Gao brothers that I was familiar with from here. And, I mean, we were in shock. And if we had been Chinese, we would not have been allowed to go into their studio. Since we were American, we were allowed in. And, I mean... It still stays with me so vibrantly. These 2 brothers, the Gao brothers, did some very political work that was very satiristic. And they weren't allowed to leave China for 17 years. They were in the Venice Biennale a couple of times, but weren't able to go. And it's really the internet that broke down their sequester. Eventually, and when I was talking to them, you know, having just walked through this door going, what is going on? They said, well, the government realized that in the end, we are just artists. And the demand outside of China was so great that they couldn't negate it anymore. They had to let them dialogue with the world. And as a result, I mean, it's interesting. Yes, there's some criticism of the Chinese government, just like there's criticism of the American government. But it's put into a broader picture that I think that the Gao brothers coming from China to some of the great museums and art centers that we have in the United States has done far more for China. So I think slowly, the doors are opening. But you're talking about a regime that's trying to control 1 billion people, 3 times the population of the United States.
Hmm. All of whom want a car and a refrigerator and a dishwasher. And
want to run free for the first time in memory.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think it's up to the young people in China to change things there? Or is it programs like What Brought You There?
I really think it's a major dialogue. Having been a resident through the Red Gate residency program, Red Gate Gallery is one of the longest established galleries in Beijing, founded by an Australian who, Australia and China have a fabulous import-export exchange. There's been a long time dialogue between the two countries. And he went to China right out of college because he was fascinated with what was going on there because it's so vibrant. I mean, imagine the electricity of things opening up. You can feel it. It's palpable. His friends that he became aware of had no place to show their work. So 27 years ago, I think it was, he started the Red Gate Gallery, and it's fascinating because it's in one of the guardhouses in the imperial fortresses that are here and there still surrounding the old city. And the artists are phenomenal, incredibly phenomenal. So what he wanted to do was establish more of a dialogue for his Chinese artists, because they were quite isolated, as you can imagine. So one of his best friends is Julie Seagraves, who's the director of the Asian Art Coordinating Council based in Denver. And she's been bringing shows back and forth for over 25 years. So when I was hitting my wall creatively, she was like, oh, get out of the U.S. scene. Where it's really happening is Beijing. So we would sit at these fabulous, very casual dinners with enough gallery employees between us that could translate for us, because, of course, they don't speak English. And there's over 2,000 dialects of Chinese. I speak not even a quarter of a one. And it would be these conversations that were so exciting that the translator would be like, you've got to stop. My brain is going to explode. There's so many ideas here. So I do think the dialogue is magnificent. In my compound where my studio was, there was a art school. And these students were being taught the most classic educations, which, to be honest, I wish I had. But they would come by my studio all the time. They walked past it twice a day, going to school, going back. And I always left my door open so that they could come in, because they were so hungry with what to do with these skills.
You know, there are, I think of a lot of questions for you. Number one is their written language is so different than Western Indo-European languages. I'm wondering if you picked up on how that might affect the way artists think, because, you know, they're picturing their words.
Well, they communicate in pictures. That's very clear. And part of the body of work that I started there have these two characters that I've turned into smokestacks, because you can't get away from the pollution in Beijing. Mm-hmm. And you also can't get away from the fact that they're very direct. Here you're in this city. I can't remember if Beijing was 22 million people, you know, just in the proper of Beijing, something like that. And if they needed more energy, you would have a nuclear reactor sitting right next to all of the residences that were being powered by it. You know, where in our country, we put it in Nebraska or South Dakota. They don't there. It was astounding to, like, have that be so evidenced. So these two characters formed the word that I used in my artwork, formed the word freedom. Of course, they also said 250 other things. But when people came into my studio, especially the students, they would look at me and they would somehow be able to say freedom. And I'd say yes. And that would spark a huge conversation because, of course, what is here? What is there? What is freedom? How important is it? What are we willing to do to maintain it, ensure its longevity? Everybody in China wants everything U.S., like you said. You're exactly right. So we have to be very careful, I think, as to how we are packaging things. I mean, if you think about it, there are many environmental things we can get away with, negative environmental things we can get away with here because we've got one-third the population and an enormous amount of space. They can't in China. And if we are the leaders, we need to lead with integrity.
So I'm assuming that what people will see at the Wiley next week is a direct result of all of these experiences you're describing.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. And I started them there. You know, I was so overwhelmed in a good way. I mean, I wanted to be knocked off my block. I wanted to change my thinking. And what, of course, I learned is that they're just like me. These people, especially the immigrants that I met that weren't part of my program, in a way, I was an immigrant, too. And we had so much in common, and everyone wanted to love and, you know, live a good life. And so that was, you know, something to get to know the other, you know, and make sure that you realize yet again we're all the same. So that was major. Another thing that really overwhelmed me is I'd go out for a day in Beijing and I'd come back to my studio and I'd go, Beijing is terrible because of X. And then I'd eat my noodles and I'd go, oh, just like in the United States. And then I'd be working. And for me, the best way for me to cognize ideas is to sketch. And as you know, I'm a sculptor, so I wanted to make sure I did two-dimensional things. So I was working a little differently than I normally do. And I could think out loud. And so I'd start thinking about, okay, so what is it about the United States? You know, why are we here? You know, and so I chose the Washington Monument as my inspirator for one of the visual depictions of the United States. And I set it up as a cross in some of my pieces, but, you know, mostly that sort of pinnacle of looking for a new view. I think everyone who came to America, wasn't the United States yet, wanted a new view for thought, religious freedom, you name it. And in China, the symbol that I used was the Imperial City and Tiananmen Square, because it really spoke about their incredible history, incredible contemporary mode, where the communist state really helped a lot of people and didn't help a lot of people, just like all governments. It works, it doesn't work at different times. So what I did and what you'll see at the Wiley are these two symbols. One is behind in some of the pieces and one is on top in the other. I use some transparent materials in order for you to see through one culture into the next. Mm-hmm. Because even though we have so many differences, we also have so many similarities.
You were there in 2009?
Yeah.
So that was 4 years ago. Have things changed?
They've gotten better in a lot of ways. Hmm. I mean, they're really trying to juggle their version of capitalism. And as we are, mm-hmm. you know, 2008 happened mm-hmm. just after I left, and or before I left. I do think that the internet is probably the greatest saving savior of having us be aware of what's going on there. And so I think it's vital that people are getting information out. I mean, you can recall, of course, all the factory strikes and difficulties that we're getting all the information of. And there's an enormous amount of support for freedom there. So,
is the economic boom happening there now, Nancy, benefiting artists? Are those newly rich people buying the art in China?
In fact, what's kind of wonderful is that they're only buying Chinese art.
Huh.
I didn't really have a fantasy that I had two exhibitions there as part of our program. And part of me was like, I wonder if anyone's going to want to buy anything. And then it became very clear to me that I was there soaking up the energy that they're soaking up also. The middle class in China is the largest group that is growing. The people who have power and money have had power and money for a long time. And, you know, their government is quite corrupt and based on the exchange of, you know, money and favors, and works like anywhere else, to be honest. The middle class is starting to really shape the country. I think that the government is for the first time, or now it's in growing time, starting to realize that this billion people are pushing them. And I think it's a good thing.
Hmm. Interesting. The time you spent there led to the works that we'll see at the Wiley. This isn't your normal medium.
That is correct.
What we're seeing there. So I'm wondering how what you learned there and what you've very well described here today has affected your sculptural work.
You know, I appreciate that question because it really has. First of all, I love sculptors' drawings because they have a physicality about them that no other drawings have. And so these pieces that I did, what I realized, there are lots of layers. So you're looking from one thing to another. And at the opening of the show of the Wiley, I have some pieces before I went to China that surprised me in all their layers. So it's been this thing in my mind that, you know, life is not black and white. It's just shades of gray. Hmm. And the whole show that I did about China is all shades of gray. Hmm. I also learned a tremendous amount there about mulberry paper and using traditional Chinese inks. I decided to do that. And they were all many of them are formally mounted in the traditional scroll way. And then I mounted them with the New York Times printed on Mylar.
Oh, interesting.
And so, you know, what is here, what is there really was a hand in glove in how they're constructed.
Artist Dick Carter had his first Carbondale show at the Launchpad last June. Here he explains his 50-year art career, mandalas, mentoring, and the Down Valley art scene. Well, the two shows previous to this one have been knockouts, so I'm sort of expecting the same.
Well, to me, it's a knockout. This is a body of work that I've spent just close to 3 years working on, and this is the first time it's been out of the studio. So I think it looks pretty good in there. Over that period, I probably did close to 40 paintings, maybe a little more than that, actually, and a slew of drawings. And so this show is... there's 9 drawings and there's, I believe, 20 paintings.
And they're all mandalas, or basically playing on that idea.
That's right. I call it mandalas considered because I'm not really doing mandalas. I've taken the mandala as a sort of inspirational form. I wanted to paint square. I wanted to use heavy color. I wanted to do a lot of line drawing. I wanted to use a centered image. So all those things just sort of clicked as taking this sort of ancient form and, you know, playing with that for my own purposes and my own kind of formal needs as a painter. So that's how I got into it. Yeah, and I don't mean to purport that they're mandalas, although one of the things that a mandala can do is focus your attention on this sort of centered image and purports to be, you know, a way to meditate on the nature of the cosmos, the universe. And I like that idea. One of my big influences is examining the effects of particle physics, astrophysics, things like that. I'm certainly not a physicist or a scientist. We've heard that before. And but I do like the visual effects of those, you know, investigations. And so I do include that. So in that way, maybe it's something like a mandala that you would, it would inform your meditations or your concept of the universe.
Are your artistic meditations different than your spiritual meditations? Or are they the same?
Yeah, I think they're the same, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, I definitely think they're the same. I mean, I'm not spiritual in a, you know, religious sense, but I feel like being on the planet, in the universe, being aware of all that. Most of my work is based on natural sciences, and that's reflected. Even though, you know, you look at it and you see a lot of geometry, it's really, it's a lot about science and natural phenomena. And so in that sense, that's where my spirituality lies, in being aware of that kind of thing. And, well, and then just trying to be a good person, whatever that is. They have a certain spirituality, my spirituality, you know, my concept of the universe. Mm-hmm. I think one of the lines in the essay is that, you know, if a mandala is supposed to help you reflect on the nature of the universe, then these paintings are a pretty good picture of my universe.
Hmm. Interesting. The dictionary definition of a mandala is a geometric figure representing the universe, oftentimes a circle enclosing a square, although I didn't see any examples of that in what, at least on your website. So maybe there's a little bit of subversion there.
Well, two things. If you, one of the things about these paintings is that they are just as much drawings as they are paintings. So one previous to this, I had spent a decade working in graphite on paper, drawing things like lightning strikes, icebergs, the night sky, again, natural phenomena. And so I wanted to continue the line aspect in these paintings, as well as saturated chroma and all that sort of thing, and the formal aspects. So if you look closely at these, you'll see a ton of drawing. I draw with Prismacolor pencil on the panels over the paint, and there's a lot of structure going on there. So you'll see a lot of circles enclosing squares when you look at them closely. And then there's a lot of squares enclosing circles. So, I mean, those two geometric forms are the basics. So, so there is a lot of that in these.
Some of those drawings that you refer to reminded me of Spirograph. Do you remember the Spirograph?
Yeah, I do, yeah. Uh-huh.
And also Leonardo's Vitruvian Man.
Absolutely.
Some of the drawing behind that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're drawing over the paint.
Yeah. What,
after the paint's dry.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
The paint's acrylic and it dries pretty fast. I mean, mm-hmm. So I'll do the whole painting part of the thing first and lay all that out, the centered image, the border. I have a fascination with borders in my work. It's just something I have a hard time getting away from. But they're there in this, but I didn't want them to be traditional borders, so they're fractured borders. They're islands of color that are sort of scattered around the edge that, you know, in a way are a border, but they're not what you would consider a traditional border. So in that case, there's a little subversion of that form.
Large pieces, too. Most of them 3 foot square, 4 foot square.
They're 5 foot, 4 foot, 3 foot, 2 foot. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. They're all panels, wood panels. They're MDF on poplar frames.
MDF, medium density fiberboard.
That's right. Quarter inch. Yeah. It's made to be painted. It's made for furniture. But you have to really support it. We use 2 inch poplar frames to keep it from, it'll buckle otherwise, you know, it's susceptible to moisture. Uh-huh. But if you frame them really great, they're, you know, or back them really well, they're fine. And it's terrific to paint on. I mean, it's just made for acrylic paint, it really is. And so I discovered that actually one of the things I do is as an art director, a production designer in film is, you know, we build a lot of sets and we use MDF a lot because it's paintable really quickly, really nice. So I just discovered by using pieces of it. So all of these were made in L.A. by my set builder and shipped out here. And, you know, I had something like 60 empty panels to start working on. Hmm. It's kind of get you going.
And you mentioned you ended up with over 40. How many are in the show?
There's 20 paintings, and then there's 9 drawings. They're 20 and 18-inch drawings, and they're pretty interesting, too. They hang in a grid in the dance studio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You were not trained in an art school, I understand.
No.
You trained yourself.
Yeah, self-taught. Mm-hmm. Right.
Huh.
I went to Villanova University. I took an art history course. That was it. And I started painting. I had an older brother who was an artist. He went to the School of Visual Arts in New York. I grew up in New Jersey. And that got me interested in contemporary art. And then I used to go over to Manhattan, go to the galleries, Museum of Modern Art for sure, Whitney, Met, and, you know, just absorb that. And somewhere in my sophomore year in college, I started painting and just, you know, had to work through, what am I doing?
So that was 60s New York. That means what? Andy Warhol, Rauschenberg?
Oh, yeah. The New York School was in full bloom. Uh-huh. You know, it was de Kooning, Pollock, Rothko, Gottlieb, on and on. Franz Klein, you know, just terrific stuff. Really heavy-duty macho art kind of, you know, but really great. Yes, and Warhol for sure, and mm-hmm. Lichtenstein.
What did you take from that, from seeing that up close as a young man?
Well, I mean, I didn't know what I was going to do. I was taking general social science courses in college, and, you know, so somewhere around my sophomore year, I thought, you know, I should be an artist. I mean, I feel it, and I'm drawn to it. And I just started doing it. And I guess the sort of fabulous feeling you get when you walk into a gallery and see a really great painting, you know, you say, I want to do that. I want to get that.
Hmm. So you moved to Aspen in the early 70s, and your first big break was an assistant to Herbert Beyer.
Yeah, that was a stroke of luck. I was working, pouring cement, doing construction, odd jobs like that. Repairing furniture for the Hotel Jerome. And, you know, I ran into somebody who worked at the Aspen Times and said, you know, Herbert Beyer, his assistant is leaving and he's desperately looking for somebody. I didn't even know who Herbert Beyer was. Went to the library, you know, got the books out and went, oh, Bauhaus, nice. So I went and interviewed and he talked to me a couple times. And I said, you know, things like, look, I don't have any formal training. I'm self-taught. It was cool. He was, well, you'll learn by working here, you know. And so I did. I worked in a studio in Red Mountain up there for about 5 years. And then when he was in Santa Barbara, I went back and forth quite a bit for another 2 years.
Well, he had his hand in a lot of different forms of art, didn't he?
Oh, man, I did everything. He would give me a maquette, and I would work on the paintings. And that would be anywhere from 8 feet square to, you know, down to the smallest paintings, I guess, we did were about 30 inches square. Did a lot of painting. I worked on maquettes for tapestries, carpets, prints. I even worked on some of the architectural stuff. He was the art consultant for Atlantic Richfield, so R.O. Anderson was at the Institute at that time, and we did tons of stuff on their building in L.A., a 50-story building. It was great. I mean, it was really amazing amount of work. Worked on a lot of the sculpture stuff that is still a couple of really big pieces in L.A. that I worked on. So that was a great break. And then he got sick. He had to move out of the altitude, went to Montecito, wanted me to move out there. I just didn't want to leave the valley, you know. And by that time, I had a sort of a career going, so... Mm-hmm. You know, I stayed. And then I would go out and do special projects, help break in his new assistant. So
do you think that Bauhaus influence explains your interest in geometry?
Well, I would say it was a lucky coincidence that I got a job working for someone who was at the Bauhaus because I was doing geometric work before that. My primary interest in art was Russian constructivism, you know, Malevich, Lissitzky, people like that, that just talked to me, that kind of art. So I was into that, and I was, when I met Herbert, I was doing constructivist reliefs on canvas. They were wood reliefs that were totally geometric that, you know, came out from the canvas, painted just monochrome pretty much. He bought several of those for Atlantic Richfield, actually. So I was already in tune with that. But, you know, he had the fabulous library of, you know, color theory books and all that kind of stuff. So I had access to that. And just, you know, it's just working. I'd work for him 8 hours a day, and then I'd go home and have dinner and go to my studio and work there. So
wow.
It's the best education.
Huh. How about that?
Yeah.
Well, looking at your resume, I was impressed by a number of things. The first is that you never stop. I mean,
you can't stop.
You not just producing the art, but you were involved at the very beginning of the Aspen Art Museum.
That's right.
And sat on its board of directors. Same with Anderson Ranch. Same
yep.
with the Wiley, which is now Art Base.
Yep.
You just never stop.
Well, I mean, that stuff is it's. You know, I always say it's part self-interest because I want to live in a community that's literate and, you know, and educated and intellectual and enlightened. And so the museum came out of, well, it was a strange thing. It was actually a reaction to when I first got here, I was invited to be in a show, and I was sort of embarrassed at how it wound up being displayed and stuff. And I went to their board and I complained, and they said, well, why don't you do something about it? So I was working for Beyer on Red Mountain. I drove past that Holy Cross building every day, twice a day. And, four times a day. I went home for lunch. I would go in there and pay my Holy Cross bill. And I would think, man, this is just a shame. This building is cool. And so when that building was taken, was purchased by the city and the old hospital and the Wheeler Opera House, I and got two other artist friends, and we started making a lot of noise that should be a museum. And the city was forming committees to decide what to do. And we packed one of the committees with people we knew would be sympathetic. And it's hard to believe that it happened when you think about it. I mean, it took about 3 years of really incredible work to get everybody on board to the point where the city financed it, you know, $1 a year rent, whatever it was. It was great. It was then called the Aspen Center for the Visual Arts. We didn't consider it a museum in the traditional sense, but mm-hmm. that term gets kind of used.
Well, your timing was exquisite. I mean, the 70s, great artistic and political ferment in Aspen, and that effort comes right out of that time.
Yeah, it's a different museum now, let's face it. I mean, it's I'm still supported. I'm a big-time supporter. I love the building. You know, I have some questions about the overall curatorial activity, but, you know, and it's just continued to be an amazing thing from what we started. I just feel like, you know, when we started it, we had a much more sort of democratic look at art. You know, we had, you know, medieval American Indian. We had New York. We had Leo Castelli. We had, you know, it was a real variety of things because we were the only game in town. And so I miss that sort of variety about what we can see there. But, you know, that's who's ever running the board runs the show, and they're paying the bills. So there you go.
Right. Well, a lot of that ethic, I don't know if that's the right word, moved down valley, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's
pretty vital happening down here.
Well, there's a whole, you know, we look at the country and talk about a disappearing middle class, and there is definitely a disappearing artistic middle class. You know, I always have had a gallery on the street in Aspen. I've had, you know, they come and go, of course, like any other business, but I've always had somebody on the street to show my work, and I've always done very well as a result of that because it's a good market. But, you know, the last 10 years, we've seen such an infusion of money that the rents in Aspen now make it impossible to really support a gallery that isn't selling pretty much blue chip art. And I've had a dealer just tell me that recently that, you know, he'd love to show my work, but I'm not expensive enough. And so you can say, well, raise your prices, but, you know, that's another conversation. But so a lot of the middle class in art has been forced out of Aspen. If you look around, there's really soon to be only one gallery that's really local, and everybody else has disappeared. So there's a lot of activity down here because of that too. You know, listen, I would love to have this show, you know, downtown Aspen. Economically, I'd probably do a lot better, but I'm perfectly thrilled with what I see here because the community is down here. You know, I'm big on art community and people getting together and doing things. So, it's just a natural flow. I mean, I'm involved with another organization too called TACAW, which we're going to build a performing arts center at Willits.
Oh, I've heard of that. Yes.
Yeah. It's going to be very special, and it's totally feasible, and it's going to happen. And, it's again, because the center of the valley is in the Mid Valley now. Mm-hmm. I mean, between Aspen and Glenwood, that area is the middle of the valley. And there's so many people down here. I mean, listen, all the people that work for most of the nonprofits now live down valley. They can't afford to live in Aspen. So, you know, we, the people, are now in the Mid Valley. Mm-hmm. So this will get a lot of support. I'm convinced of it. I feel this is a lot like when we started the museum. You get the feeling that it's going to really serve a purpose.
I wonder if that artistic and political ferment, which we spoke about in Aspen, some of which has moved down valley, does that still, obviously it's still important to you as a person and I suppose as an artist.
Right.
And evidently your efforts, you know, to facilitate that are ongoing. If somebody comes to you, where am I going with this? What's going to happen in this valley? What artistically are the artists? You know,
well, I think
the artists are in danger of being priced out even of the Mid Valley if they're not already.
And this is not just true here; it's also true. I just spoke to someone, you know, who has a gallery in New York, and she opened up right next to David's Warner, practically, and you know, is paying an enormous rent because the art world has inflated prices so out of control. And, you know, she sits there and watches people go into Zwerner all day long. And, you know, she's not selling that kind of middle class art that at one time people, because people in the middle class have less money. People at the top have a lot more money. So what are they going to buy? I mean, that is a happening effect right now. So I just feel most of the artists I know live down valley. Not all by any means, but, you know, we live down here. We play down here. You know, we're going to show down here. And, you know, I think that will encourage institutions like Launchpad, like the Art Base, like TACAW. I mean, these things are gonna be viable because this is where the audience is now.
Mm. And do you think that would encourage foundational and governmental support for the arts?
Well, it
that
should.
That kind of dynamic?
I think if there's a weak spot, I would say it's that governments better recognize that the arts are a super economic format and that they can really help a community in all kinds of ways, but certainly economically as well. And you would think a government would respond to that. But honestly, I don't see that in, say, the Mid Valley towns right now. They may know it, but they're not paying
not
the
there
big
yet. There's not a critical mass.
No.
Do you think that's because there's not the population to support it?
No, I don't think it's the population.
No.
I think it's, you know, there's other agendas at the moment, I guess, for people. But really, the people who are running local governments really have to see that this is an important aspect of creating a viable community, a real community.
Mm-hmm.
And that cost. So they got to fork it over.
I'm assuming that your involvement with a lot of these arts organizations in the Valley includes a mentorship aspect for younger artists. Do you give yourself that opportunity to bring along the next generation?
Well, it's interesting you ask that. I started a fund at the Art Base when my wife died in 2007. It's in her name, Claudette Carter. And it goes for two things, but the primary thing is an art. There's a group of artists in the Mid-Valley that mentor Basalt High School students. And right now there's three artists doing it, and they will take a junior in high school, and they will the student goes to their studio one day a week, and they do this for a year, and they put together a show. And the Art Base right now actually is doing these shows. They're getting a show a week each, a one-person show, these mentees. And so that gives them something when they're a senior looking at colleges to have a sort of a portfolio as well. So this is a really great project. So we've been funding that for a number of years now, and continue to search for money for that. And it's actually works.
What do you see in the young artists these days? Do you see yourself at that age, or do you see something entirely
different? No, because
I
really have a hard time remembering when I was that age. I'm 70 years old. I just know that for a lot of young people, it's finding that one thing in life that, kind of gets you going and gets you out of that, what the hell am I going to do with my life thing? And so, having an artist spend time with you in that kind of quantity of time is really, it's enlightening. So hopefully, they may not become artists, but they hopefully will become smarter and more understanding people.